pressing the phone to his ear. I watched as he paced back and forth, and then finally put the phone in his pocket to stare at the grass, bending at his knees. We continued south across the Animas Valley on a broad dirt road. Suddenly, Manuel slowed to a stop. "What is it?" I asked. "Shh," Beto whispered, pointing to the road. There, barely 5 yards from our sputtering vehicle, an antelope stood, staring at us through the windshield, regarding us with wide, shining eyes, as if we were a band of misfit ghosts. Outside the passenger window, another animal shuddered beside the road, too fearful to follow its partner. Later, as we drove up into the pine oak woodlands of the Pelencillo Mountains, a pack of Cotamundi, 30 strong, paid us no mind as they swarmed the road in front of us, sniffing the dirt with pointed noses, their round bellies low to the ground, their tails held high in the air. We stopped at an abandoned campsite, deep in the Pelencillos, to eat our bagged lunches. Beto and I sat across from each other at a picnic table, while Manuel stayed in the vehicle to listen to the scanner. "Is everything all right?" I asked Beto. He set a sandwich on the table. "It's my cousin," he said. "He died yesterday in Juarez. My mom just got the news. She doesn't know yet how it happened." We ate our sandwiches in silence, and then Beto laughed to himself and began to tell me stories. He told me about crossing the border with his cousin to party in Juarez when they were still too young to drink. He told me about house parties in El Paso, about drinking in the desert at the edge of town, about the two of them chasing girls at the clubs and bars when they finally turned 21. He trailed off and shook his head, and I watched his eyes track the movements of a red bird fluttering between the branches of an oak tree. "It's weird," Beto said, "all these animals." He paused, thinking. "You know, yesterday, when I was pissing at the edge of the road, a black butterfly flew right in front of me, a big one. I can't stop thinking about it." He continued nervously, as if he was afraid of what I might think. "A few years back," he said, "the day before my grandma died, I saw one just like it in the West Texas desert, flying out across the grass." At night, off duty, Hayward drove us up into the mountains. As we climbed, we could make out white patches of snow on the sides of the highway. We drove into town, parked by the old theater, and walked straight to the nearest bar, a place called the Buffalo. After we'd ordered, I put a handful of quarters in the jukebox. When the first notes of Marty Robbins' El Paso began to ring out, Beto smiled widely and looked over at me, letting out a Mexican grito. After our first beer, I walked with Manuel through the cold to a nearby gas station to buy cigarettes. On our way back, we stopped at a bridge over a deep-set creek and blew smoke as we spoke into the dark air. "My wife and I are going to buy a house," he told me, "on the east side of El Paso." "That's great," I told him. "Congratulations." Manuel stared down into the creek. "No one in my family's ever owned a house," he said. Back at the bar, Beto was talking with a middle-aged woman, his hand resting on her thigh. "This is Susie," he smiled. "She says we ought to go up the mountain to the opera house." "Shit," said Hayward. "That sounds fantastic." We left the bar and crowded into his truck, with Susie in the front seat, guiding us up a winding road. The windows of the old opera house glowed with warm light, and inside it teemed with people and smelled of wood smoke. The floors and the ceiling were made from wood, and the adobe walls looked the same as they might have a century ago. We sat and ordered beers and listened to the men singing and playing fiddle, our bodies absorbing the warmth and the smoke and the sound of it all. Outside, I stood with Hayward to escape the crowd, and he told me about his wife, about how he married his best friend, about how you know you've met the right person when they don't aim to change you, but appreciate you for who you are. Manuel and Beto tired quickly of the fiddle music, and soon we were driving back down the mountain with Susie to have one last drink at the Buffalo. After another round of beers, Beto began to sway. He danced with Susie, putting dollar after dollar into the jukebox. Hayward, still sober, sat with Manuel and me, telling us about growing up in Virginia. He was a quarterback in high school, he told us. His wife was the head cheerleader. "That's how we first met," he said, "at the football games. Hayward's father, a police chief, encouraged him to join the force as soon as he graduated from high school. Hayward was the youngest recruit they'd ever had." An old country gospel song came on, and Hayward smiled. "Before all that," he said, "I used to sing in a gospel group with my brothers and sisters. We toured around some," he said, opened up for some pretty big shows. He smiled. One of our songs got recorded by one of the big gospel acts. I turned away and saw Beto leaning in to kiss Susie. As Hayward drove us back down the mountain, Beto snored in the passenger seat while I stared at the lights of the town and the valley below, twinkling like a place of happiness and promise. I drove with Manuel and Beto through a broad desert valley to the border. For several hours, we sat parked next to a water tank in a low canyon, listening on the radio scanners to the scouts, one on a hilltop to the west and another in the mountains above us. A man with the codename Metro Cuatro called to Alpha Tres, describing our every move along the dirt road, noting each time we turned or parked or stepped out of the vehicle to piss. The scouts left their positions at nightfall, and the frequencies went silent. The next day, when we resumed our sweeps, the frequencies were still quiet. At night, we parked at the water tank, and the stars glared above us in a moonless sky. We sat in our vehicle and listened to a cartel lookout crew south of the line. Manuel told us that they were following an armed convoy along a Mexican highway. We could hear how the men worked themselves into a frenzy, how some of their voices cracked with excitement and adrenaline surging through their bodies, and how others whimpered with panic. The lookout crew is in charge of protecting the local boss, Manuel explained, and the convoy is made up of members of a rival cartel. Later, a man named Victor Chulo came on the radio and told his crew that the convoy was passing through the territory with the blessing of the boss. They're probably on their way to a cartel ranch for a high-level meeting, Manuel told us. I imagined what the ranch must be like, how the stars might look from there. It must be up in the mountains, I thought to myself, hidden in a beautiful place where I must never go. Beginning in 2008, the writer Charles Bowden conducted a series of interviews with a former cartel hitman, known in Mexico as a sicario. Bowden eventually arranged for the sicario to sit down for several days of videotaped interviews with Molly Malloy and the Italian filmmaker Gianfranco Rossi, who compiled his testimony in the documentary El Sicario, Room 164. As a condition for appearing on film, the sicario insisted that his voice be altered and his face obscured, so it was agreed, at Rossi's suggestion, that he would wear a black veil over his head, much like the hoods used by executioners of old. In Bowden's preface to the book that compiles these interviews, he writes of the sicario, "Nothing in his appearance signals what he has been and what he has done. Yet he has managed to kidnap people, torture them, kill them, cut them up, and bury them when the rest of us cannot imagine doing such things." In his testimony, the sicario describes the act of killing. "I never doubted at the moment I got the order. I never doubted. I just pulled the trigger. I could not even think. I did not know the person. For me, it was nobody." He goes on to explain how, almost as a rule, he and all the cartel men he knew and worked with were always high and drunk when carrying out their work. After killing or torturing a target, the sicario says, "I did not fully realize what I had done until 2 or 3 days later when I was finally sober. I realized how easy it was, that the drugs and the world I was in were controlling and manipulating me. I was no longer myself." When those they had kidnapped were executed, the bodies were buried in mass graves known as narcofosas. Quote, "I think that here in the border region that, well, let's say that if there are 100 of these narcofosas, maybe only 5 or 6 of these places have been discovered. I cannot tell you exactly how many people have been buried in this fashion. It is impossible to say," end quote. Nevertheless, he says, "these numbers are very important, very representative. 100 persons. Can you imagine 100 people buried in a cemetery, but they are piled on top of one another? Can you imagine trying to identify, trying to recognize those people? Can you imagine, in a 120 square meter lot, 10 meters by 20 meters, that there are 50 people buried in a common grave?" The sicario describes the lengths to which the cartel goes to obscure the identities of its victims. Quote, "It is necessary to put lime and other chemicals on the bodies, to remove all of their clothing and other belongings so that the bodies will not leave any traces, so that they cannot be located or identified," end quote. After our team concluded its operation in New Mexico, my co-workers returned to El Paso for the weekend and I stayed behind to pay a visit to my uncle, who had recently retired and moved from Santa Fe to the outskirts of a small town in the Boot Heel. I arrived Friday night after dark, and my uncle greeted me at the door, hunched and backlit by the warm glow from the house. He hugged me under the porch light. "It's been years," he said. He backed away to inspect me, his hands at my shoulders. "You look strong," he said, gesturing for me to come indoors. Inside, the house was filled with boxes and unarranged furniture. He let out a nervous chuckle. "I'm just renting until I can get something built out at the property." His eyes gleamed. "We'll go out for a hike tomorrow," he said, "and I'll take you by the site. You can tell me what you think." In the morning, I awoke on the couch and found my uncle gone. I browsed lazily through the living room, looking through boxes of my uncle's old photographs. There were images of him and my father, his only brother, hiking through the mountains of Southern California and New Mexico, grinning as they tied fishing flies onto long lengths of line and arched their rods toward sparkling streams. My uncle, having no children of his own, had collected endless images of me and my half-siblings, each of us separated from the other by many years and great distances. There were pictures of us as infants, as toddlers, as young children posing clumsily for our elementary and middle school photographs. Farther down in one of the boxes were images of my father beaming at the sight of our young mothers, his many past wives. In one photograph, he stands at the edge of the sea with the mother of my youngest half-sister. In another, he stands on a green hillside with my mother on the first day of their short marriage. My mother, luminous in a white cotton blouse and a purple shawl. My father, with a striped shirt loose and whipping in the wind. I looked up from the box and glanced out the window to see my uncle making his way toward the house. I stood and watched him from the kitchen window as he jogged down the dirt road in a slow and gangling manner, his hands sheathed in leather work gloves. For years, a degenerative disease of the peripheral nerves had been coursing through his body, eating away at the muscle tissue in his feet, arms, and hands. Unable to flex his calves to draw up his forefoot, he lifted his knees all the way to his waist in order to run without stumbling. The gloves, he told me later, were to protect his hands when, inevitably, he would trip and fall to the ground. After a small breakfast, my uncle took me out to the property along the Arizona state line, where he had laid the foundation for his new home. "It's not much," he said, shrugging. I looked out across his flat and dry acres, laid over with pale grass and tangled thickets of mesquite. I could sense that he held misgivings about the isolation, that he was eager for me to find something of worth in the yawning landscape, the tremendous dome of clear sky. "I'm not sure exactly what it is," he said as he looked out at the property with his hands on his hips. "I guess it just feels good to be close to a place that's still wild." I looked across his land to the horizon. "You can see mountains in every direction," I said. We drove west toward a trailhead at the base of the Chiricahua Mountains and stopped at the place where a creek, cold with snowmelt, flowed over the dirt road. My uncle ushered me out of the car and pointed to the pale and leafless trees looming at the banks of the creek. "I came here for the sycamores," he told me. He lifted his legs to step over the rocks at the edge of the creek, explaining how the trees reminded him of the sycamore canyons that cut through the mountains of Southern California, where he'd spent his young summers working in an apple orchard with my father. He told me about the day he first came to this spot, on a trip with his second wife in 1992. He recalled how they stumbled upon the same creek bed flowing across the road, and then, as if recounting the discovery of some cherished thing long ago traded away, he described his breathless surprise at finding these great white trees from his youth. "I couldn't sleep that night," he said, "because of the sycamores." The next day, he and his wife went driving in the mountains above the creek and came across a small and perfect apple orchard. My uncle looked upstream. "I've been back up in these mountains time and again since I moved here," he told me, "but I can't find a trace of it. Not even an overgrown clearing, not even an old stump." He rubbed his hands against the cold and stared down at the slow current of the creek. "I still dream of apple orchards," he said, turning his face toward the water. We arrived at the trailhead in the late morning and set out together up the North Fork of Horseshoe Canyon. As we hiked past fire-blackened trees, my uncle began to recount all the natural things that he had been made to destroy in the years he worked as a contractor in Santa Fe. At one job site, he tore down a mighty pine tree and cut it into pieces. On another job, he carved a road into a still wild hillside. He described the guilt that consumed him in the weeks after such acts, visiting him even in his sleep. "It's overwhelming sometimes," he said, "to think of all the trees I've killed, all the scars I've left on the land." I wanted to tell my uncle that I had known men to do much worse, that I still carried with me images of landscapes laid to waste, places riddled with the shells of burnt-out vehicles and piles of rusting bicycles, places where even the most isolated trails and roads were lined with every kind of trash imaginable, blankets and burlap bundles, old clothes and cut wire, twine and polstrine handcuffs and gallon water jugs spray-painted black, stomped on and slashed open, awaiting the slow decay of coming centuries. I wanted to tell my uncle that I had known men to engage in senseless acts of defilement, depositing car seats and furniture on far-off hilltops and in remote washes, decorating cacti with women's undergarments, hanging twisted bike frames from the towering arms of saguaros, dislodging massive boulders to tumble down sloping mountainsides, and setting fire to anything that would burn, abandoned automobiles and trash piles and proud desert plants left to smoke and smolder through the night. We continued hiking until we arrived at the high wall of a crumbling dam, where we decided to stop for a lunch of apples, cheese, and peanut butter. As he ate, my uncle seemed to me like a small and gentle bird, and I wondered at his capacity to demolish the landscape, despite his need for solace in wild places. He turned to me and smiled. "How's your job?" he asked. I chewed an apple, thinking of how to reply. I wanted to tell him that I had reached a point at which I could barely sleep, a point at which my mind had become so filled with violence that I could barely perceive beauty in the landscape around me. I wanted to tell him that I feared there was nothing for him here, that he would find no peace in these borderland deserts. I breathed a deep breath and looked over at the water, held back by the sagging dam. "The job is good," I finally said. "It's nice to be out of the office, to have some work back in the field." My uncle leaned on one arm and joined me in looking out across the dark waters of the lake. Later, as we made our way back to his truck, I thought briefly that I might tell him about the wolf dream, that I might confide in him my fear of coming unraveled. We walked side by side, and I watched as he lifted his knees, his dangling feet thudding upon the trail. I worried, briefly, that the blood that ran in him might be the same that runs in me, blood that fills the head with visions, that pulses away at sleep, that eats slowly at the muscles, blood run through with ruin. I jogged through the streets of El Paso to Rim Road and up Scenic Drive. The air was cold and thick after a winter rain, and white wisps of smoke rose from the smokestacks east of the city. To the south, I looked out across an expanse of streets and buildings to where dark clouds had gathered over the tops of the Juarez Mountains, above white words that had been built into the mountainside with massive piles of painted rock. "Ciudad Juarez," they read. "La Biblia es la verdad. Léela." The lettering was ugly and crude, but it reminded me where I was, above two cities stretching across the floor of a once mighty river basin, ringed by arid and stony peaks, seething and glimmering as the residents prepared for the coming night. To live in the city of El Paso in those days was to hover at the edge of a crushing cruelty, to safely fill the lungs with air steeped in horror. As I ran and drove through the city, oscillating from work to home, the insecurity in Juarez drifted through the air like the memory of a shattering dream. In news, in academic texts, in literature and art, the city was perpetually presented as a landscape of maquiladoras, narcos, sicarios, delinquents, military, police, poverty, femicide, rape, kidnapping, disappearance, homicide, massacres, shootings, turf wars, mass graves, corruption, decay, and erosion, a laboratory of social and economic horror. This narrative of a city fractured by its looming border, saddled with broken institutions and a terrorized populace, had become part and parcel of its legacy, the subconscious inheritance of all those who came within the city's orbit. To comfortably exist at its periphery, I found myself suspending knowledge and concern about what happened there, just as one sets aside images from a nightmare in order to move steadily through a new day. Now, as night settled over the valley, I struggled to discern the exact location of the border as it flowed through an illuminated expanse. I thought about the places I had seen in Juarez, the turnstiles and taco stands, the storefronts and snack vendors, the blinking stoplights and the intersections teeming with cars and people. People I had seen extend, without hesitation, the most basic kindness toward one another. People who lived and breathed in the city as if it were entirely ordinary, as if it were a place worth coming to, worth living in, worth remaining. I held Juarez in my mind, and I felt a pull to go there, to walk confidently through its parks, its sidewalks, its market halls. I felt the city's pull, even as I knew, with sinking certainty, that I would not go, that something I had chosen now kept me from crossing over. In Ringside Seat to a Revolution, author David Dorado Romo examines how the Mexican Revolution was photographed, filmed, and commodified from the Twin Cities on the banks of the Rio Grande, which together served as the intellectual crucible of the insurgency. A carnival atmosphere prevailed in El Paso during the buildup to the Battle of Juarez, and both cities were awash with international journalists, photographers, and filmmakers, as well as all manner of mercenaries, thrill-seekers, adventurers, and spectators. Tourists from El Paso crossed the Rio Grande to pose with insurgents and their horses in the encampments on the river's southern bank, feigning steely resolve with rifles clutched in their hands and bandoliers slung across their chests. When the large-scale fighting finally erupted in May of 1911 between federal soldiers loyal to President Porfirio Diaz and the renegade armies of Francisco Madero, commanded by Colonel Pancho Villa and General Pascual Orozco, El Pasoans scurried to the tops of trains and buildings to witness the bloodshed. 25 cents could buy you a viewing spot from the rooftops of the Mills Building, the Sheldon Hotel, the Union Depot Tower, or the El Paso Laundry Building. And if fighting did not materialize, you could ask for your money back. Newspapers in El Paso ran advertisements suggesting, "It is foolish to expose yourself to any danger in connection with the troubles in our sister republic. You can see everything, even to the smallest details, if you get a good pair of field glasses." The urge to witness the mayhem was so strong that people were willing to risk their lives to be spectators. And during the battle, 5 El Pasoans were killed and 18 wounded on the American side of the line. The newspapers reported that Juarez looked as if a hurricane had struck it. Buildings were blown apart and left to burn through the night. Daylight revealed streets littered with splinters of wood, plaster, broken window glass, and adobe debris. To some, the ruin of Juarez was a thing of wonder. Joseph Sweeney, a former mayor of El Paso, remarked that it was a beautiful sight to see shrapnel bursting up in the air and scattering its death-dealing missiles on the hills and in the valleys surrounding. In the aftermath of the fighting, sightseeing cars ran advertisements for trips to the ruins of the battle-scarred city. Only a year before, the residents of both cities had been brought to their rooftops to witness a very different event, the passage of Halley's Comet across the night sky, visible to the naked eye for more than a month. 700 miles away, in Nuevo León, in the city of Monterrey, my unborn grandfather swelled in the belly of his mother. I imagine how his family might have gathered together at some high point in the cool air of an early summer night, my great-grandparents holding their children close as they gazed, awestruck at the cosmos. I imagine Tiny Frances, my great-aunt, beholding the comet as an incomprehensible streak of light. Beto invited me to go with him and his friends to a nightclub in downtown El Paso. We made our way through hot crowds of scantily clad women and sweating men, taking turns buying rounds. I watched a woman in a red dress dancing with a man in the roped-off VIP section at the center of the dance floor. Beto leaned toward me and shouted in my ear, "I wouldn't look at her if I were you." "What?" I asked. "She's with a narco," he said, lowering his voice. Beto gestured at the man, and I watched as he grabbed the woman's hips, his bleary eyes rolling back in his head. For much of the night, I danced with a thin, dark-haired woman. She led me by the hand to an outdoor terrace, and I stood in the cold with her as she leaned against the brick wall of the nightclub, smoking a cigarette. "I don't like it here," she told me. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Earlier," she said, "when I went to use the bathroom, a couple came up to me. They were older, in their 40s maybe. They looked like they had money. They were good-looking, you know, dressed in expensive clothes. They spoke Spanish like they were from Spain or something. And they tried to convince me to go somewhere with them, to their house or the house of someone they knew, I'm not sure. There was just something about it," she said. "I didn't like it." She hurriedly smoked her cigarette and tugged down at the hem of her dress, and then crossed her arms in front of her chest. Inside, the woman drifted away from me and disappeared into the throng. At the end of the night, as the bars closed and young people flooded into the streets and parking lots, I searched for her outside the nightclub, craning my neck to look over the crowds. Beginning in the mid-1990s, femicide, the killing of women, became the hallmark of Ciudad Juarez, an emblem of the danger and chaos unfurling along the border. Mexico City journalist Sergio González Rodríguez was one of the first reporters from outside the state of Chihuahua to cover the murders for a national audience. In The Femicide Machine, González describes the archetypal crime of the era. Quote, "The victims were abducted from the streets of Ciudad Juarez and taken by force into safe houses where they were raped, tortured, and murdered at stag parties or orgies. The victims' bodies were dumped into the desert like garbage, tossed onto the streets, on corners and vacant lots in the city's urban and suburban zones, and in the outskirts of the city," end quote. By dumping their victims in empty lots and trash heaps, González asserts, the perpetrators of these crimes negated the essential humanity of their victims. Quote, "To leave a raped, abused, half-naked woman's body in a garbage dump is to re-signify the body with indifference and abjection. The act suppresses the distance between objects and humans and calls out for savage disorder. Through it, the victim is reminded of her restricted status in domestic and industrial spheres. Her identity is predestined not to exist." End quote. Even as international attention began to focus on the city's femicide, the identities of its victims were obscured by sensational narratives. Women were represented as young and powerless, engaged in exploitative employment in U.S.-owned manufacturing facilities known as maquiladoras, and preyed upon as they bussed home from work or reveled in the city's nightclubs. In an interview with the Texas Observer, Molly Malloy describes how these narratives served to fetishize victims, representing their bodies as, quote, "a kind of sacrificial host" or "a symbol for suffering," end quote. She conveys how the sexualized rhetoric surrounding femicide eroticized its targets, making the women, many of whom do the work and are the only breadwinner, appear more helpless and powerless than they actually were. At first, the women murdered in Juarez were assumed to be victims of a serial killer. After the suspected killer was caught, subsequent crimes were blamed on alleged copycat murderers or sex-obsessed, misogynist gangs. It was implied by local and state officials that many of the women shared the blame for their victimization because of their penchant for frequenting bars and nightclubs. The city was presented as a battleground, an active crime scene. In such places where the threat of death is incessant, there is little space for grieving. In Juarez, this paved the way for an almost ritual negation of individual loss by both those who sought to bring attention to the crimes and those who sought to dismiss them. Law enforcement exhibited no inclination to seriously investigate the murders. In 2003, the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women visited Juarez to evaluate gender-based discrimination and violence in the city. Its subsequent report found that, quote, "thus far, in the cases involving sex crimes, the murderers have acted with full impunity. Nearly all sources, including statements and comments made to the experts by federal government officials, the heads of federal agencies, and several senators, have made it clear that the local authorities, both state and municipal, are assumed to have a years-long history of complicity and fabrication of cases against the alleged perpetrators. End quote. Sandra Rodriguez Nieto, a longtime investigative journalist for the newspaper El Diario de Juárez, writes about interviewing victims of Juárez violence in La Fábrica del Crimen, translated into English as The Story of Vicente, who murdered his mother, his father, and his sister. Quote, nearly everybody I've met who has come in contact with the Chihuahuan criminal system over the femicide cases has described it as the worst experience of their lives. The victims don't get justice. The defendants lack basic guarantees of safety or legal proofs against them, which makes it highly probable that the actual killers remain at large. End quote. In 2004, the internationally regarded Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team, a non-governmental human rights organization of forensic scientists established in 1984 to investigate the thousands of unsolved disappearances during Argentina's dirty war, began its own investigation of the Juárez femicide cases. In later reports, the team documented a willfully inept justice system, with investigatory bodies prone to grave methodological and diagnostic irregularities in identifying female remains. In investigating the more than 30 unidentified bodies taken from mass graves, the team found that state authorities had often failed to label the remains, leading, in some cases, to the mixing together of the recovered body parts of distinct persons, a literal amalgamation of individual victims into an undifferentiated mass. The unsolved murders, in many ways, provided a blueprint for the structural underpinnings of the large-scale violence that would soon come to eclipse them. By 2008, little more than a year after Calderón declared war on the cartels, Ciudad Juárez had become ground zero for the conflict. As cartel violence exploded south of the border, Juárez underwent a grim transformation. It was no longer the city where women died. It was the city where everyone died. At the height of the violence in 2010, according to El Diario de Juárez, more than 3,000 murders were reported, an average of 8 per day, earning Juárez the nickname Murder City and the dubious title of Murder Capital of the World. During these same years, El Paso was named the safest city in the United States. The indiscriminate killing in Juárez and all across Mexico was so rampant that in 2012, when New York Times foreign correspondent Damian Cave reported on a new wave of killings and disappearances among the women of Juárez, even larger than those of the 1990s and early 2000s, attention could not be roused. People haven't reacted with the same force as before, a human rights investigator for the state of Chihuahua told Cave. They think it's natural. Manuel asked Beto and me if we would help him move into his new house over the weekend. Beto and I drove together to his home on a Saturday morning and joined his family in unloading a massive moving truck parked in his driveway. His wife directed us as we carried furniture into the rooms and up the stairs. As we lumbered through the living room with boxes, Manuel's two girls ran in circles around our legs. When the truck was finally empty, we sat on stools around the kitchen counter and ate pizza with his family. Manuel introduced us to his mother and father. Este es mi otro hijo, he told them, gesturing at me. I chuckled and reached out to shake their hands. Mucho gusto, I told them. Manuel's father smiled. You speak good Spanish, he told me. Are you Mexican? I thought about how to answer. Partly, I said. Yes. My grandfather's family came from Monterrey. Ah, Manuel's father said. Soy de Delicias, Estado de Chihuahua. But I've been to Monterrey, he told me, proudly. I used to drive big rigs all along the border. He sat tall in his stool. Fui trocadero, he said. Conozco todas partes. Manuel's mother and father began to tell me about the towns of West Texas and the nearby villages of northern Chihuahua and Coahuila. We used to cross the border like it was nothing, his mother said. Manuel's father shook his head. When I retired from truck driving, we took our children and drove all along the border, all the way to the Gulf. Manuel's mother sighed. What a nice trip, she said. She looked fondly at her husband and then at Manuel. Manuelito, she asked, do you remember those little villages in Big Bend? Manuel shrugged. No, no me acuerdo, ma. Manuel's father held out his hand to interject. Well, he said, I remember it like it was yesterday. People would cross back and forth all day long, like the border wasn't even there. He looked at me and raised his eyebrows. Men would even ride their horses across the river, así como en las películas del viejo oeste. Manuel's mother smiled. Es cierto, she said. It was just like the movies. She shook her head and looked down at her granddaughters eating their pizza. There weren't so many problems back then, she said. We even used to take our kids to Juarez. We would go for long weekends with the whole family, down to the lakes and mountains south of the city. The children loved it there. They fished and played in the water for days. She looked at Manuel. Do you remember, mijo? Manuel handed another slice of pizza down to his daughter. Yes, ma, claro. His mother sighed. We don't go there anymore, she said. On the way back from Manuel's house, Beto and I talked, for the first time, about our lives before the patrol. He told me how he'd always wanted to be a cop, how he'd gone to school for criminal justice, always knew he wanted to carry a badge and a gun. Growing up outside El Paso, he said, it seemed like the only ones doing well were either getting paid by the cartels or getting paid to take them down. I asked him about school, if he ever thought he'd go back. He shook his head. For me, he said, this is my life now. I've been doing it for almost 10 years. I asked him if he'd ever considered leaving the patrol. He stared out over the steering wheel. He had a mortgage, he said. He was still making payments on his car. He couldn't walk away from the money he made, unless it was for something just as good. I chuckled. It's hard for me to relate, I said. What do you mean? I live in your fucking backyard, I said. I could walk away from that whenever I want. Beto explained to me that to move forward, he would need to become a supervisor or transfer to another agency. Where would you go? I asked. He thought for a moment. Do you know the State Department has its own security force? He asked me. The Diplomatic Security Service. They get to fly all over the world. Beto smiled. Now that would be nice. I looked out the window at the concrete city south of the interstate. I've thought about the State Department too, I told him. But not law enforcement. He laughed. You want to be an ambassador, Wei? I shrugged. I used to think about the Foreign Service, I confess, but that was before the patrol. They've got these scholarship programs, though. You can apply to do research in any country you want. Beto stared ahead at the advancing freeway. Que chingón, he finally said. We sat for a few minutes. Then, Beto looked over at me. So you're looking for a way out? He asked. I shrugged. I'm not even 4 years in yet. So what? That doesn't mean you don't want to do something else, pendejo. True enough, I said. I looked out the window again. I always imagined I'd go back to school, I told him. I used to think that I'd go for law, political science, something like that. But now I don't know. When I was in school, I spent all this time studying international relations, immigration, border security. I was always reading about policy and economics, looking at complex academic ways of addressing this big, unsolvable problem. When I made the decision to apply for this job, I had the idea that I'd see things in the patrol that would somehow unlock the border for me, you know? I thought I'd come up with all sorts of answers. And then working here, you see so much, you have all these experiences, but I don't know how to put it into context. I don't know where I fit in it all. I have more questions now than ever before. Beto sat glancing at me with short turns of his head. Damn, he finally said. That shit's deep. After we exited the freeway, Beto began to talk to me about his family. He had grown up on both sides of the river and still had cousins in Juarez. We used to have these big family reunions on the south side, he told me, but now I only see my cousins when they come to El Paso to party. As we neared the house, I asked Beto if he ever went south of the line to see his family. Never, he said. Not since I've been in the patrol. He stopped for a traffic light at the base of a hill and looked down an empty side street. Even before things got really bad, he told me, I still wouldn't go. I knew it would probably be fine, but there's just something about being an agent. It never felt smart. I nodded. I haven't gone either, I told him. The signal turned green, and Beto accelerated up the hill as I wondered to myself what it was, the thing that kept us from crossing to the other side. In Antígona González, Sara Uribe writes, count them all. Name them, so as to say, this body could be mine, the body of one of my own, so as not to forget that all the bodies without names are our lost bodies. I dream that I'm in Ciudad Juárez with Manuel and Beto. We are driving at night through a street filled with people, and we park our car along the side of the road to join the crowds. We walk through the city with the people of Juárez, celebrating with them in the open air. I dance with girls in the street, kissing and spinning them in the light. I can sense that there is unease among the crowd. And every so often, Beto leans toward me to point out certain people connected to the cartel, certain vehicles to keep an eye on, certain places to avoid. In the early dawn, the crowds thin out, and we begin making our way back to our parked vehicle. As we walk along the sidewalk, Manuel gestures behind us. In the distance, men can be seen making their way down the road, killing and kidnapping everyone who remains on the streets. They're coming this way, Manuel tells us. We hurry toward the car, and I think to myself that we should have known better than to come here. We've all seen the bloody images, I think. Why did we come? We reach the car. As we speed through the city, the streets begin to fill once more with people. The city's residents are starting their morning, carrying flowers with them as they walk in all directions. How do they live with the fear? I wonder to myself. How do they survive? Historian Timothy Snyder has spent much of his career examining the terror waged against the people of Eastern Europe between 1930 and 1945, in the borderlands between World War II-era Germany and the Soviet Union. His book Bloodlands chronicles the twin genocides perpetrated by Hitler and Stalin in modern-day Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarus, and Western Russia. Campaigns of ethnically and politically motivated mass killing and starvation writ large. Snyder implores his readers to view the staggering number of deaths, 14 million, as 14 million times one. Each record of death, he writes, suggests but cannot supply a unique life. We must be able not only to reckon the number of deaths, but to reckon with each victim as an individual. Snyder explains that, quote, to join in a large number after death is to be dissolved into a stream of anonymity, to be enlisted posthumously into competing national memories, bolstered by the numbers of which your life has become a part, is to sacrifice individuality. It is to be abandoned by history, end quote. Snyder ends his book with a plea to academics and fellow historians, to all those who grapple with death on a grand scale. It is for us as scholars, he urges, to seek these numbers and put them into perspective. It is for us as humanists to turn the numbers back into people. Hayward came to my office in the late morning while I was reading through the day's news on my computer. Are you busy? He asked. No, I said, looking up from the computer screen. He stared at my face. Jesus, he said, you look like shit. Thanks, I replied. I haven't been sleeping, that's all. Well, he said, let's go grab some lunch. After ordering, Hayward took off his hat and placed it on the table. There was a shooting at your old station, he told me. Did you hear? No, I said. What happened? An agent shot and killed a Guatemalan down near the line. Damn, I said. They say it was a good shot, Hayward continued. Self-defense, cut and dried. What was the agent's name? I asked. Lopez, he said. Did you know him? I thought back to my days at the station. I don't remember a Lopez. Well, shit, Hayward replied. I was going to see if you knew how he was doing. He sat back in his seat and gazed out the window. I know how hard it can be on a man after he kills someone, he said after some time. Have the other guys told you about me? I blinked at him in confusion. What do you mean? I asked. I shot a kid once, Hayward said, back when I was a cop in Virginia. I thought maybe you'd heard. People talk, you know. He held his hat between his hands, bending and shaping the brim. When the call came out on the radio, Hayward told me, he was on his way back to the station after working a double shift. There was a plainclothes detective just a few blocks away, engaged in a pursuit with a stolen vehicle. Hayward responded with lights and sirens and blocked the vehicle's escape route down a side street. When the car stopped to make a U-turn, the plainclothes detective jumped out of his vehicle and attempted to remove the driver from the stolen car. As he pulled the door open, the driver took his arm and held onto him as he made the turn. Hayward saw that the detective was hanging from the car and being dragged across the pavement as the car accelerated. So he aimed and fired two shots, hitting the driver right in the head. "I didn't know where the bullet hit," he said, "but I saw the driver go limp and watched the car come to a stop. He was just a kid, 17 years old. There was a passenger too, a 19-year-old, unharmed." Hayward stared at his hat, an old and quiet pain spreading across his face, the likes of which I hoped I would never be made to carry. "Well, hell," Hayward finally said, "I was barely in my 20s. In their ongoing attempts to understand the roots of human violence, scientists have identified a genetic deficiency that predisposes certain men to acts of hostility. In 1978, in the southeastern Dutch city of Nijmegen, a woman approached medical experts at Radboud University Medical Center, concerned about a history of violence in her family, which included her brothers, her son, and generations of her male forebears. These men raped and abused their sisters. They chased down their employers in rage. They committed arson. They got in fights. They leveled threats against family members, friends, co-workers, and strangers. In 1962, the woman's peaceable granduncle, a teacher at an institution for the learning disabled, traced the violence in his family as far back as 1870, identifying 9 male family members and ancestors with a history of such behavior. For over a decade, geneticists at the University of Nijmegen conducted research on the woman and her family. In 1993, after 15 years of investigation, researchers identified a deficiency in a gene that produces an enzyme called monoamine oxidase A, or MAOA, a key regulator of impulse control. Individuals with low levels of MAOA, it seemed, were predisposed to violence, and researchers came to refer to them as carriers of a warrior gene. Since the occurrence of this deficiency is tied to a defect in the X chromosome, men, possessing only one X chromosome, while women possess 2, are more prone to the defect, although women may carry it and pass it on to their sons. Subsequent studies revealed that about 1/3 of the world's male population carry the warrior gene, the expression of which can be triggered by childhood exposure to trauma. Dr. James Fallon, a neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine, upon discovering that several of his ancestors had a grisly history of murder, submitted himself to brain scans and genetic analysis. His genetic results and brain activity patterns matched those thought by scientists to be associated with aggression and violence. Fallon attributed his failure to succumb to a charmed upbringing. "If you have the high-risk form of the gene, and you were abused early on in life," he explained in an interview, "your chances of a life of crime are much higher. If you have the high-risk gene, but you weren't abused, then there really wasn't much risk. So just a gene by itself, the variant doesn't really dramatically affect behavior, but under certain environmental conditions, there is a big difference." Dr. Fallon does not specify the environmental conditions that might lead to the activation of the warrior gene, nor does he suggest whether large-scale trauma, enacted over decades across an entire society, might trigger the ceaseless perpetuation of violence. He does not indicate how long our subconscious can absorb terror and fear, how long we can live in proximity to aggression and cruelty before slipping into madness. I agreed to take care of Beto's dog while he was deployed for several days on an intelligence mission out of town. Before he left, I told him that I planned a hike in the Franklin Mountains over the weekend. "Can your dog handle a steep climb in a few hours of walking?" I asked. "Probably not," Beto said. In the morning, before leaving for the hike, I fed Beto's dog and left him in the gated backyard. As I drove through El Paso to the McKellen Canyon trailhead on the east side of the mountains, I noticed a heavy spring wind blowing across the city. The wind tore at my shirt as I climbed up the canyon, the dust obscuring the views to the east. An hour later, at the top of a peak, I looked out to see the entire region covered by a massive cloud of gray-brown dust. On a clear day, I would have been able to see the West Texas plains and the deserts of New Mexico. I would have been able to look south across the city of Juarez and the surrounding countryside of Chihuahua. But with the blowing dust, I couldn't even see to the base of the mountains. I made my way back down the canyon, spitting dirt and shielding my eyes. I returned home to find the gate to the backyard slung open and Beto's dog missing. In the fading, dust-filtered light of the evening, I drove frantically through the surrounding neighborhood, searching for the dog, unable to see more than 100 yards in front of me. Through the brown haze, I saw a woman walking down the street with a hooded sweatshirt pulled tight around her face. I rolled down the window and shouted to her over the wind. "The dog catcher came through maybe 15 minutes ago," she told me. I drove back to Beto's house to find an impoundment notice from El Paso Animal Services on the door. I raced across town to the shelter, cursing myself aloud. At the shelter, I found Beto's dog covered in blood and bite marks, cowering in the corner of the kennel. I felt, briefly, as if I were in a nightmare. "He was in a fight," the officer explained. "He'll be fine, but he messed the other dog up pretty good." The officer gave me the address of a house a few blocks down the street, and I drove straight there, leaving Beto's dog curled up in the passenger seat of my truck. Standing in the front of the house, I wondered why I shouldn't just turn around and leave. Why I should hold myself responsible for a fight that wasn't mine. At the door, I was met by a disheveled woman. "I was supposed to be watching the dog," I told her, losing my words. I placed a hand over my chest and clenched my jaw. The woman stood with her hand still gripping the doorknob. "Is your dog all right?" I finally asked. "My husband took her to the animal clinic," she said, barely concealing her anger. "Your fucking dog tore her throat open, right through the goddamn jugular." I lowered my gaze. "She's getting stitches," the woman said. "We don't know if she'll make it." She stared at me with eyes wide and unblinking. "I'm sorry," I told her. We stood with coldness between us until, finally, I turned to leave. "I'll come back for the vet bills," I told her. "I promise." That night, as dust blew across the desert, I kneeled in the backyard of Beto's home, trembling as I washed blood from the face of an animal. In his book, What Have We Done?, veteran war reporter David Wood examines the pervasiveness of moral injury among soldiers who have returned from the battlefronts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Long confused with PTSD, moral injury is a more subtle wound, characterized not by flashbacks or a startle complex, but by sorrow, remorse, grief, shame, bitterness, and moral confusion that manifest not in physical reactions, but in emotional responses as subtle as dreams and doubts. In its most simple and profound sense, writes Wood, moral injury is a jagged disconnect from our understanding of who we are and what we and others ought to do and ought not to do. As a soldier tells him, moral injury is a learned behavior, learning to accept the things you know are wrong. Wood describes how most of us have a firm and deeply personal understanding of life's moral rules, of justice and injustice, right and wrong. That sense, our inner compass, is built on beliefs we begin to acquire as infants. But war, by its very nature, tends to suddenly and violently upend these remaining moral beliefs. Things don't go well in war, whose very purpose demands death and destruction. This upending is often a gradual process, one that is difficult to perceive. Likewise, moral injury is a wound that sets in slowly, something that occurs, as one Iraq veteran wrote, when a person has time to reflect on a traumatic experience. When Wood writes of moral injury, he refers most often to traumas suffered in combat by soldiers deployed in foreign war zones on the other side of the earth. But he also notes that one does not have to be in combat to suffer from moral injury. He reminds us that war is something that reaches far beyond the battlefield, something that leaches out into proximate geographies and relationships, seeping deep into the individual and societal unconscious. To be in war, Wood states, even in this broader sense, is to be exposed to moral injury. Our team was deployed to work a mission in the deserts of my old station. Before we left El Paso, Hayward came to me to say he needed me at my best. You know the lay of the land. I want you out there helping Manuel to triangulate scout locations, matching up the intercepted communications with what you know from the ground, what you see on the maps. I want to know where they're staging their loads and what they can see from their lookout points. There's a shit ton of dope moving through here. Let's figure out where it's headed. I rode through long days with Manuel and Beto, gazing out the window at the blossoming landscape, bright with green creosote and yellow plumes of Palo Verde, with red-tipped ocotillos and endless orange wildflowers. As we listened to crackling voices on the scanners, I imagined that I might know where they were, and I tried to hold in my mind their high-up views across the ephemeral lushness of the desert. In the late afternoons, we returned to the forward operating base, where we had set up a trailer to serve as our mobile command center. One evening, a few hours before sundown, Hayward suggested that some of us take ATVs down the back roads to survey the approach to a nearby scout hill. "You guys go," I told him. "I'll stay back and work on the shift report." Half an hour after leaving with Manuel and Beto, Hayward called me on my cell phone. "We ran across a quitter," he said. "Can you transport her back to the base for us?" "Sure," I said. I asked if she was all right, if she had water. "She's fine," he assured me. When I arrived, I saw Hayward, Manuel, and Beto standing over a small woman sitting in the middle of the dirt road. Hayward walked over to me as Beto and Manuel continued speaking with the woman in Spanish. "We checked her pockets," he said. "This is all she had." He handed me a cell phone. "Her group left her behind. Looks like she got a pretty bad limp. Probably has some nasty blisters." Manuel and Beto walked the woman to the back of my patrol vehicle and helped her into the back seat. "Vete con cuidado, señora," Manuel told her before shutting the door. I looked up at the sky and then at Hayward. "You should get going," I told him. "There's not much daylight left." "Whatever you say, boss," he said. "Just don't forget that report." As I drove down the dirt road back toward the base, I looked at the woman in the rearview mirror through the mesh of the metal cage that separated us. I tried to think of something to say, but found myself unable to speak. "Is it all right if I roll down the windows?" I finally asked. "Lo que usted quiere, oficial." I rolled the windows down and turned to look at the woman. "Me puedes tutear," I told her. Cool air blew in from outside, and I gazed beyond the road at the dust devils creeping across the warmly lit valley, a myriad of clay-colored cones whirling in the distance. For a short time, driving down the open road, I felt a strange and familiar sense of freedom, an old closeness with the desert. Perhaps there was something comforting, I thought, about being able to look out across the landscape and see for myself the horrors laid upon it. I looked again through the mesh to the woman seated behind me. She stared out the open window, her hair whipping at her sun-wrinkled face. I wondered what she might have seen, what she might feel looking out at the desert, and I was certain it was no sense of freedom. At the forward operating base, I parked and helped the woman out of the vehicle. I offered her my arm as she limped up the walkway to a small holding area. Inside, she sat on a cold steel bench as I asked her a series of questions to fill out her voluntary return papers, the only semblance of conversation I was able to have with her. "I'm 46 years old," she told me. "I was trying to get to Phoenix to see my husband. My group crossed 4 days ago. They left me after the second day. I come from Guerrero." After filling out the paperwork, I asked the woman if I could see her feet. "I'm an EMT," I told her. "I can tell you how bad they are." She took her shoes off slowly, embarrassed at the smell. "It's all right," I said. "I've smelled it before." As she removed her socks, the fabric, stiff with days of dried sweat, pulled at the skin of her soles. The balls and heels of her feet were covered with silver dollar-sized blisters. I opened a medical kit and put on a pair of gloves. I touched her feet, turning them slowly in my hands. "They're okay," I assured her. "I've seen worse. Most of your blisters are unbroken." I cleaned her feet one at a time with a disinfectant wipe, swabbing the fluid from the edges of her broken blisters and smearing them with ointment. Slowly, I unraveled a roll of white gauze around each pallid